interview with Drummond on J2 engines.
And I wonder if we could begin by having you make some comments on your personal experience in the J2 engine program when you came into it, some of the things that you remember most, and maybe we get into more specific questions.
Well, okay, I'll tell you when we started and how long I was with it. In November of 1959, it became public. Hello, Frank. How you doing?
All right.
All right.
Where you get that jazzy?
Starting again.
Okay, we're on.
November of 59, it became public knowledge that a lot of we civilians here at Huntsville were going to transfer from the Army to NASA. And actually, in December of 1959, while we were still on the Army payroll, we started working with NASA people out of Washington. And we started on the technical requirements for a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine. And had a heavy input into the request for proposal that went out in early February of 1960, and had a heavy part in the evaluation of those proposals. And the decision to as to what contractor got the job was made on May 31st, 1960, by the administrator. And we actually started negotiating the contract in June, spent July that way, in August. And went under contract to Rocketdyne Division of North American on September the 1st, 1960. And of course, we, some 4,500 of us had been on the NASA payroll since July the 1st, 1960. And I was with the J2 project from December of 59 until August of 67. It was quite a forward step, I think, in the state-of-the-art on liquid hydrogen engines. The previous work on this type of engine had been done by Lewis Research Center in Cleveland in conjunction with the Pratt & Whitney Company in West Palm Beach, Florida. And they had built the RL-10, which is on your list here, yes.
We talked to Stewart this afternoon, I think.
Rod Stewart this afternoon.
We will talk to him.
And of course, that was a much smaller engine, around, I think, 15, maybe up to 20K thrust before they were through. And the J2 was started at 200,000 pounds thrust. Mm-hmm. And it was uprated during the development to where it could go up to 230, 235, adjustment of the orifices to drive the pumps faster. And we took the conventional approach in the development of a rocket engine with a regeneratively cooled bell nozzle, which we had some 10 to 12 years experience with alcohol and kerosene engines. Mm-hmm. We tried to stick to conventional approaches as much as possible to try and minimize the development time. And of course, we ran into the normal problems you do in any engine development program. You don't know your real problems until you put the thing together. It's an entire engine. You can component test the thing to death. You don't know your problems until you put it all together and try to make it work as a system. And of course, the development time took longer than many of us had originally hoped it would. And I guess we spent some 60 months before we actually had an engine that we felt was worthy of first flight, and spent longer than that getting it developed to the state where we wanted it.
What kind of development problems did you run into that lengthened your development time? Can you pick out some specific things and give us some example of your fix on them, how you solved them finally?
Well, I think our big problems was in the turbo machinery area. We again took an approach which had some development behind it. We took an actual flow turbo pump, or pump rather, for the hydrogen. where all of our experience in the kerosene and liquid oxygen area had been in a centrifugal pump. Hydrogen, its density being so light. Rocketdyne, I believe, yes, Rocketdyne had been doing some work on the, what was called the Rover Project, a forerunner of the nuclear engine project, mm-hmm. where they had had a ground test pump of the actual flow concept and had been in use in that program. And we took many design concepts from that and put it into the J2 flight pump. Mm-hmm. The gas generator, which drives the turbines, we had the normal amount of development problems there, getting the distribution of the propellants and that proper, so we didn't have hot spots in the gas generator. Mm-hmm. We ran into problems there. Had to redesign the valving, combination valving and spray nozzles, sprayed the fuel into the combustion chamber of the gas generator. We had injector problems. We made full use of the knowledge and experience that Lewis and Pratt Whitney had gained in their injectors. And our only problem was we had to make that much bigger. We ran into some manufacturing problems there.
Did you use the same kind of injector that they sent back?
Yes, we certainly did.
Could you describe that a little bit for us here?
Oh, gosh. My boss has a nice picture of the model. A chunk out of the injector.
Is it this Regimesh?
We use the Regimesh, and a certain percent of the hydrogen was flowed through the Regimesh to maintain cooling on the injector face. The LOX was flowed through so many posts, seems like around 250 posts that came down through there. You'll have to live with my memory problems here a little bit. I've been away from it for 4 years now. I guess that's about all I can say about the injector. Getting the cooling near the edge of the injector, the outer circumference of the injector, of course, was a problem. We went through quite an extensive development program there. We also were concerned about and conducted quite a few tests for stability. When hydrogen gets extra cold, there was a probability of having combustion instability. We ran a program on that and frankly found that that wasn't near as much of a problem in the hydrogen injectors as it had been in the F1 engine, for instance. They had quite a combustion stability program on that engine.
Is that a function of size primarily?
No, no, I don't think so. It's more a function of the, well, in the case of the kerosene engine, of course, it was always a liquid. Mm-hmm. In the case of the hydrogen engine, by the time the stuff got to the injector, the combustion zone, it was a gas. Mm-hmm. And as we approach the colder temperatures to where we are going to have a phase change from gas to liquid, we were concerned, but this just never happened. We never had a problem there. Our big concern was getting liquid oxygen to the engine and letting it change to a gas there. We were concerned about having gas back up in the inlets to the engine. Proper amount of insulation. We had double walled bellows going to both the these are the double wall bellows going to the hydrogen and the oxygen pumps, and by the proper amount of insulation, even external to some of these bellows, and the ducting up into the tanks of the two stages, we did a lot of work in conjunction with the S2 battleship stage, and this ended up not being a problem. I guess another new new concept that we tried on this engine was where we fed the hot gases to drive the turbines in series from hydrogen to oxygen and into this exhaust duct. Mm-hmm. That was a fairly new thing, and that worked out real well. It was a matter of the proper amount of development testing to get the orifices proper so we had the right gas temperature and the hydrogen turbine and still had enough left over to drive the LOX turbine.
How do you model that when you want to get the right orifices? Do you put it on a computer? Do you have enough data from other expansion programs that you can do that, or is it just...
You kind of, well, in this particular case, we had some data from the RL-10. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's not a simple matter to scale up from a 15,000-pound engine to a 200,000-pound engine. So you take that to start, and you run some short duration development tests to get some additional data, mm-hmm. and you keep running this through the computer as you gather additional data. And this is a big help, of course, in the final analysis. You're working your way up by steps to a combustion system. And then, of course, the back pressure from the size of your orifices and this exhaust duct, that you try by computer, and you get the final answer, of course, when you put the thing together. I can't recall how many hundred development tests we did over the years. Have you talked to anybody in the engine program office on J2?
Not here. No, we have been out to Rocketdyne and talked to Paul Fuller on it.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to talk to anybody in the engine office here?
Yeah, we'd like to talk to Blue and Brown, especially.
We have interviews scheduled with Thompson sometime.
Jerry?
Yeah, with Bob Pease. We talked to Dick Rogers already.
Okay. And you're going to talk to Bob Pease?
Yeah.
Okay. He can probably tell you a lot more than I can because he's still with the engines, and he lived with the J2 on site of Rocketdyne up until a little over a year ago, I guess. Back here.
One thing that still is unclear to me is how the engine really evolves in terms of the relationships between Marshall and, say, Rocketdyne. I mean, did you more or less design the engine in Marshall and say to Rocketdyne, here it is, or did they design it and say, here's the engine, now what do you think of it?
No, we came up with the requirements for what we wanted the engine to provide.
Just like you're doing on the shuttle, including specific impulse and thrust?
Yes.
Was that specific?
Yes, it was that specific. It was quite a thorough document. Was more than a
flow rates,
RFP, I think.
Flow rates and all that? Or?
No, I don't think we went to... I don't think we could be that specific. We specified the thrust we wanted and a range of ISP that we desired, which we thought was attainable from what data was available on the hydrogen-oxygen combination. Mm-hmm. And we did specify that we wanted a conventional bell chamber. Mm-hmm. So anything else would have been too big a step, mm-hmm. we thought at one time.
Were anybody during this time trying to sell ideas like Aerospike or things like
No.
More Aerojet concept.
Well, things were a little austere in 1959 and 60.
I have one question along with that. As you know, the Silverstein Committee suggested the use of LOX hydrogen for the upper stages, and that was December 15, 59. And it seems that you were engaged in this in November of 59.
No, you misunderstood me. In November of 59, it became public knowledge that a bunch of us Army civilians...
Yeah.
I worked for NASA in December of 59. In fact, on December the 28th, which happened to be my birthday, was the day we started working on this thing here in Huntsville. Mm-hmm. That's the reason I remember this specific date.
Okay, so what I was trying to isolate is, obviously the Silverstein Committee had to have inputs to decide to go to LOX hydrogen. Now maybe these came from Lewis, from his long period as director of Lewis.
I'm sure it did.
And not from a Marshall-sponsored thing, because
yeah,
Marshall or ABMA had never been into hydrogen before.
The requirements for the engine came from a lot of studies. I'm sure that was one of them. We were specific enough in our RFP that we specified that this engine should be capable of being used by itself, a single engine, or in a cluster. We didn't say how many. The requirement was there for a larger payload capability if we were going to do any more in space. I can't say that the requirement to go to the moon was there at that time, because it wasn't. You always have to start your engine development program earlier than your vehicle development program, because it takes a longer time, and you need an engine before you can do any
vehicle
kind of qualification flights on a vehicle. So we were specifying, we allowed, let's say, the contractors to propose on a 165K engine or a 200K engine. And the reason we did that, because we had 165K engines at the time. We had the H1, which was already 165. The three major contractors that proposed, Aerojet, Pratt & Whitney, and Rocketdyne, all proposed at the 200K level.
Mm-hmm.
They were allowed the option to go in steps, you know, do a pre-flight rating program on 165 and a qualification program on 200. They all chose to propose to go to the 200 originally, which, well, Monday morning quarterbacking is the way to go. If you want a 200K engine, you start out building one. And, that wasn't too big a step from 165 to 200.
Yeah, but isn't this engine itself capable of, just by changing fuel mixture, about a 239, 237?
Well, I've been away 4 years. When I left, I think 235.
Uh-huh.
We could orifice, get the right mixture ratio, and get up to 235. That came later. That was not a requirement.
Is this an expensive program to operate the engine?
No. once you get your basic engine developed, to operate it isn't real expensive. We have a lot of good history to support that on the H-1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's been uprated 4 or 5 times, I guess. I don't even know what it is. I think it was 205K the last time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a relatively inexpensive thing to do. Now, you don't make a big jump, you know, from 150 to 200 in one step, but you take it in increments. And, kind of by fine-tuning your pump system, usually, and your injector is what gets you there. But the uprating from 200 to 235 wasn't expensive in the J-2.
Nevertheless, this is a change in the contract when you when you uprate. Does the contractor stand to make money that he perhaps lost on the original development program by uprating? Chance to catch up a little bit.
I'll have to say this: anytime you put in a change to a contract, you have to say that there's an opportunity for the contractor to recoup a little bit if he's lost. The only way I know out of that is to go to a fixed price contract and don't change the requirements. Yes, Lynn. Of course, I don't know of any program in the history of NASA that's done that.
I was going to ask you about the other bidders. I thought there were 4 bidders on it.
There were 5.
You remember who they were?
The other two was, GE bid. GE submitted a bid. Reaction Motors did not bid. They came to Bidders Conference. Bell, I believe, submitted a bid.
Yeah, so
I won't be 100% sure about that. I know GE submitted a bid.
Aerojet, Pratt & Whitney, Rocketdyne,
GE,
and Bell.
How is this source selection made? Do you have any insight into that?
The
announcement was by the NASA administrator.
Yes, the source selection, we had a technical evaluation team and a business evaluation team, and these fellows lived in Washington for about 6 weeks, I guess.
TDY from here?
Some were from here, some were from Lewis. Mr. Pease was on one of those teams. Jerry Thompson was on one of those teams. I personally was not on the team. I stayed home and here in Huntsville and fed some information to Jerry and Bob Pease. Then the source, or or rather the technical evaluation teams made presentations to the source evaluation board. Mr. Herman Widener, our director of S&E, I believe, was the chairman of the SEB. The SEB, in turn, made presentations to the administrator.
Mm-hmm.
That was Dr. Fellow went back to Case Institute.
Glennon,
Dr. Glennon. And he made the announcement the last day of May in 1960. So the...
Do you have any idea where that selection was made? Is it just made out of the findings of the committee and Glennon announces it, but it's really a basically a Marshall decision?
Oh, no. I wouldn't say this is basically a Marshall decision at all. No.
You'd say it was more an overall NASA decision?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so this thing was really conducted out of NASA headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
A gentleman by the name of Dale Tischler was kind of, I don't recall his exact title, but he was kind of chief of the propulsion group at NASA headquarters. And we supplied him people from here. Lewis had people on the evaluation teams. And he was kind of, I guess, chief coordinator of the evaluation. And I'm quite sure he was on the source evaluation board. And this was handled as the way we're still handling them today. You have evaluation teams, and they in turn report to a source selection board or source evaluation board, and they in turn make presentations on a big procurement that usually ends up to the administrator. And then the administrator makes the selection. I know that's the way it was done on the J2.
Do you remember the kinds of technology that were transferred from Lewis Engine Experience, say, to the RL-10 that went to the J-2? Could you make some comments about the interplay and the interflow of information that leads from one engine program into the next one?
Yes, I can comment to that fairly detailed, I think. I personally went with Jerry Thompson and a couple of injector experts from Rocketdyne to Lewis, and we spent a couple of days up there going over data they had collected, drawings that they had on this type injector. We went through manufacturing processes on the injector. Lewis had a little manufacturing shop up there where they had made some prototype engines. We went through the manufacturing process on the regeneratively cooled tube thrust chamber. We did the same type thing on their turbo machinery. On the RL-10. And at Mr. Tischler's, well, let's say it was policy at that time, had a program review about each 3 months at Rocketdyne usually, and we had a kind of a team that went for the first couple of years anyway, and we had Lewis people on our J2 team.
Yeah, excuse me, let me ask you something. You went to Lewis to look at the injector stuff and the turbo machinery.
Mm-hmm.
Was this
in the thrust chamber?
In the thrust, was this basically RL-10?
Yes,
material?
And RL-10, or let's say that, well, RL-10 covers a lot of sins. I guess that covers from the time that Lewis started in the hydrogen engine field, and I believe that's around 1956 they first started playing with this.
Mm-hmm.
56 or 58, Rod Stewart can fill you in on that.
Okay.
I guess, to put it bluntly, we took Rocketdyne and went to Lewis to pick Lewis's brains to get all knowledge that they had into Rocketdyne's hands to see that they could, if they could make use of it, and they did make use wherever possible. The Ridge Mesh injector, for instance. the regeneratively cooled tubes, Rocketdyne had to go to a different manufacturing process, mainly because of the physical size of these tubes.
Lewis wasn't annealing them and bearing them out of that, what kind of nickel alloy is that that these things have?
Inconel?
Yeah, we use Inconel also.
Yeah.
But the actual process of forming the tubes and putting them together had to be changed because the RL-10, you know, is a little bitty rascal.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I forget the height of this offhand, but that's a pretty tall.
11 or 12 feet, I think. Mm-hmm. Actually.
It's pretty darn tall.
Well, Rocketdyne just buys those tubes from a manufacturer. They just get them in a, you know, big thing, and then they buy them bent.
They were farming their own tubes years ago. They may be buying them today, can't say. They were farming their own. Putting them together and furnace brazing techniques were a little different. They used the same basic metals.
About what time were you up at Lewis then with the J2 people going through Lewis's files?
Well, my first trip was September 1960, right after the contract was initiated. We worked closely with the Lewis people, real close, for I'd say at least 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, they took on an engine development program of their own. And, however, we kept in touch with them and kept them. Let's say we kept utilizing their knowledge anytime a problem came up.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then this. Let me make a statement here. You tell me if it's right or wrong. I was wondering where Pratt & Whitney's experience filtered into the J2 program. And the point of filtering then would seem to me was Lewis, because Pratt & Whitney would have their reports at Lewis, and you had access to all Lewis's stuff, so that's how the transfer is made.
Well, if there was any direct contact between Rocketdyne and Pratt & Whitney, I wasn't personally aware of it.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
We took the data that was available to the government at Lewis and made it available to Rocketdyne.
Mm-hmm.
There was no infringement of proprietary rights, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going back a little earlier, there was some work in hydrogen technology at Caltech and in Aerojet. Did any of that technology get into the loop?
Well, I guess I can't answer that. I wasn't personally aware of it. Who had the contracts with?
These were just individual, you know, kind of laboratory operations.
Was the government involved?
I think the Navy sponsored a little bit of the research.
Navy. I wasn't aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, can you go on from there a little bit and tell me more about the, or tell us a little bit more about the development of the J2 after you got the materials from Lewis? And
Rocketdyne just started by doing an injector test.
Uh-huh.
With an old heavy short thrust chamber, which is again normal. They started doing turbo pump development test. We were going to get this job done in 45 months originally. And as I said before, it took about 60 months.
Mm-hmm.
We got into our PFRT program, pre-flight rating test program, a little behind schedule, came through it in pretty fair shape, and went into the qualification program. When I left, we were under contract to deliver or to buy from Rocketdyne about 155 engines. I don't know where we are today, if we bought that many or if we're under contract to buy more. We had to satisfy two different situations. We had to satisfy the S4B application, single engine. We had to satisfy the S2, which was a 5-engine cluster.
Mm-hmm.
During the development of the vehicle along with the engine, after President Kennedy and Congress decided we were going to go to the moon, requirements on the J2 increased. We started out with the requirement that it only had to run for 250 seconds. That had to be changed to 500 seconds. It had to be qualified for 500 seconds. It had to have a restart capability. That was not original requirement. Once you started, let it run and quit.
May I ask you a question along here? Did you have to establish separate production? facilities out at Rocketdyne for the engines that were going on the cluster and the, those that were going on the...
No, we did not. That was a requirement from the start that...
They were to be the same?
They were to be the same.
In other words, with some slight modification, you could use the S2 engines on the S4B?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, as far as acceptance testing of the engine went, we could take one and send it anywhere.
Hmm.
There were, as I recall, it was simple to put in the restart capability. It was just simple to have it in all the engines, although the S4B is the only one that uses it. Before we delivered the engine, we had to know where it was. I can't remember what the heck it was. Seems to me like it was in the lock line to the gas generator. We had to do something. Mr. Pease can tell you that. There was a